everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2025, and you're listening to episode 432, which is a conversation about the work of the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge and is part of our Literary Apologetics series. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Mitchell, who holds a PhD in humanities and teaches English and humanities at Covenant Day School in North Carolina. Stephen has written an online article for the Christian Research Journal in our Literary Apologetics series. His article is called "Love, Not Rocks, All the Way Down: Horror and Hospitality in the Rime of the Ancient Mariner." And you can read his article for free at equip.org. That's equip.org. Stephen, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Thank you, Melanie. It's good to be back.
Well, Stephen has written another article in our Literary Apologetics series. And today we are going to be talking about Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now, people might think that that name is familiar because they probably have read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, like I did, and it was either middle school or high school, read that. So it's somewhere in the back of your mind that you might have read that in high school or college or something like that. But we're going to focus on his work today. And I want to start out by asking Stephen who he was, why his work is important, and also for the Christian apologist, because I want everyone to tune in for the entire episode. You know, why is this important that we even consider his work in light of apologetics?
Sure. So quick refresher maybe on Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So he was with William Wordsworth, one of the early kind of inaugurators of what we call as a literary movement, British Romanticism, British Romantic poetry. With Wordsworth, he published lyrical ballads, and of course, Rime of the Ancient Mariner figured prominently in that publication. And that publication of poetry in 1798 shifted British poetry out of what was perceived as a kind of stiff, deadening formalism, at least many of the Romantics perceived it that way, into a sort of warmer and more, I suppose, common concern. Common language, common themes is a big part of what Coleridge and Wordsworth were trying to achieve. And that's kind of the literary poetic movement. And it's important, though it isn't really the focus of what we're going to talk about today. But there wouldn't be a Romantic movement, or it wouldn't look as it does without the work of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is a secondary school standard insofar as, you know, a school might teach British literature, because it is such a key romantic text. As such, it's probably the case that people might be inclined to sort of pass over it as just one of those representative texts that you read, and then unless you're going to go on and study, you know, English at the collegiate level, you sort of forget about. And it can be taught, I think, almost too often as a sort of just a poem with a kind of sentimental "be nice to everyone" message. But I don't think it is. I think it's actually a profound work of, we might even call it poetic theology in a way. Coleridge was in fact a devout Anglican Christian his whole life, and something of a lay theologian, in addition to being the consummate poet that he was. And so his concerns, or his interest as a poet, I guess, are deeply interwoven with Christic themes, Christian theological themes. I think one of the ways that literary apologetics helps us is, less often, though not absolutely never, but less often in dealing directly with questions of, like, you know, the existence of God or the nature of God or the believability of God, so much as, you know, it's it it's a way of grappling with anthropology, like with what humans are and the kind of creatures we are and the implications of our behaviors and of our choices. And I think that the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is a really powerful poem about the human tendencies to kind of to seal ourselves off in oppositional groups, to turn others into rivals and competitors and enemies, to deny, if you will, hospitality. And I mean that not just as, you know, inviting someone to eat soup with you, but that kind of deep welcoming of the other that is, in fact, one of the central characteristics of the nature of God. And I think Coleridge understood that tendency in his own time, though we're not going to necessarily talk about it in relationship to, you know, the early 19th century Britain. But I think Coleridge understood that that there is a risk deep in the human heart to turn our backs on our fellow men, and to do so very often seemingly in the name of being reasonable or being virtuous or being realistic, and that turning begets a situation of real viciousness. And so he uses the Gothic horror genre to frame this problem in really intense and vivid terms. That's probably what people remember most about the poem, is its Gothic imagery, its Gothic intensity, its use of, you know, spirits and ghosts and supernatural events. But that's important, right? And he was telling intentionally a tale that would have, you know, popular appeal, but he was deeply concerned with what happens to human beings when they fail to answer the divine generosity that brought the world into being with a similar generosity, when they fail to act, if you will, like God. I mean that in the sense of being his, you know, his representatives here on earth. So that is the answer I would give to why this matters. It's much more than just an introduction to British Romanticism.
It would be helpful for our listeners, I think, if you could, you know, give us the basic plot of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. I know sometimes when people see poetry, they automatically think, like, I won't be able to understand this, as much as, oh, if it was a novel or an article, I could get a better grasp of it. So I would just like you to just kind of give us an overview, because I think that way it won't be so daunting as people think back to, oh, I read this thing and it was just like over my head or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, happy to do that. And yes, I understand that tendency to think of poetry that way. And I think one of the wonderful things about this poem is, first of all, it is a narrative, right? So it is, it's a narrative poem. So it does tell an actual story. And second, because Coleridge was trying to work in that, you know, common themes in common language, it is a quite an accessible poem. The rhythms, the rhymes, it's all linguistically, it's quite easy. And so I'm going to go through it all, but, you know, to maybe remind people of that in British literature, this was probably the one poem that they thought, oh, I get that. But the basic of poem is, it opens with three young men headed to a wedding, and one of the three is stopped by this strange old man. And he wants to tell him a story. The wedding guest doesn't want to hear it, obviously, and this is what he's called throughout the poem, the wedding guest. He doesn't want to hear it for a number of reasons. One, the most obvious, is he has a wedding to get to. He's been invited, and in fact, he calls himself the next of kin to the bridegroom, so he probably has some official duties. But this old man won't really let him go. He has a kind of almost a supernatural sort of hold on him. The old man is the mariner of the title, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, a term for a sailor. And so he has this story he intends to tell, which it turns out is a story of his own experience, of horror on a sailing expedition he was on. The long and short of it is that he and his shipmates left home on their ship. They set for sail. They were quite cheery and merry and, you know, high expectations for this journey. They reached the equator. They got just past the equator, and storms took over and blew them essentially down into the far southern reaches of the globe, toward the Antarctic continent. So they're surrounded in this ocean. There were some storms that blew them along that were, you know, vicious and out of control. And then they find themselves surrounded by ice and surrounded by fog and mist. And in other words, in, you know, late 18th, early 19th century shipping or sailing, like in real dire circumstances, right? Because they can't see, they can't get out of this ice, this is risky. And they have this sense, as is expressed in the poem, that they are just kind of isolated, that the world itself is a kind of monster waiting to devour them. The imagery talks about this. But the thing that happens, and Coleridge himself said this was, in his words, a crime on which the whole action of the poem would turn. While they're in the midst of this problem, and a wind has come up that has started to blow them back north, so to get them out of this predicament. And as this happens, this bird, an albatross, they haven't seen another living thing for a long, long time. And this albatross crosses the path of the ship, lights on the mast, and they're just jubilant. They're excited to see it, another living creature, a sign that they're not the only sort of living things in this alien, what seems like an alien world. And they welcome this bird. They share their food with it. The poem itself says that they welcome it as if it had been a Christian soul. It stays with them for about 9 days. And then the mariner just decides one day to kill it. And he just shoots it, kills the bird. Coleridge's notes that he published with the poem make a point of this being an act of inhospitality. He inhospitably killeth the bird of good omen, is what the lines say. And this begins a whole new dimension to their trip. They end up back near the equator, but they enter this area of the ocean that is almost supernatural in its in the setting. It becomes monstrous. It becomes hellish, if you would. And they begin to suffer from the heat. The wind drops down. And they can't move, right? So this is that era of the fear of the doldrums, right? Where there were these vast stretches of the ocean near the equator where there just wouldn't be any wind for weeks or months at a time. And of course, if that happens to you on a vessel that's moved by sails, you're in trouble. They run out of water. They can't, you know, their thirst becomes intense. And the world appears to them as this kind of monstrous prison, if you would. And it's clear in the poem that this is retribution for having killed the albatross, right? And they're moving closer and closer to death. So then more elements of the supernatural come in. This kind of ghost ship appears, and there's two characters on it, Death and Life and Death. And Death, the Grim Reaper, takes all of the rest of the crew, 250 other men. And then Life and Death takes the mariner. And so his punishment as the one who actually killed the albatross is to remain alive while everything else around him dies, and while whatever does in the sea live on sort of becomes to his perception a loathsome, gruesome, revolting, inhuman isn't quite the right word because they're not human, but I mean just like gruesome creatures. Everything he sees, everything he perceives is repulsive to him. It's probably important to note that Coleridge makes much of the fact that the sailors who had died there, that they had implicated themselves in the mariner's crime by affirming his killing of the albatross when they conclude that it had brought the fog and mist. So they had been still bothered by this fog that they were trying to sail through. It was an obstacle. It made their journey difficult. So they make this superstitious conclusion, because once he kills the albatross, the fog lifts. They draw the superstitious conclusion that the albatross had brought it, and that therefore he deserved to die. And so they affirm what the mariner had done. All of this, what Coleridge is setting up, is a whole really world, if you would, a microcosm there on the ship of people who root all of their ethical thinking in self-interest, right? A thing is good or evil, right or wrong, insofar as it contributes to my comfort and my own well-being. And what's more, there is a sense that because the resources available to me are limited, any being or any creature that would have claim to any of those resources is a rival, right? As the albatross was conceived, because he ate some of their food. And so it begets this kind of murderous competitiveness. Anyway, the mariner is reduced almost to death. And then there's this wonderful moment in the poem where there is this overt movement of divine grace. And because he's dealing in the Gothic world, or in this Gothic genre, he can make the supernatural, you know, sort of almost literally present in the poem. And this mariner who has turned his back upon the albatross and by implication upon the world that is the gift of God, and so experiencing this hellish isolation, is very tenderly brought back into the human fold, and he is restored after this period of suffering that he goes through. Then the ship sails on, brings him home, and just before he gets back to his home, the ship sinks, and he, you know, all of the dead men are, you know, their bodies sink with the ship, and so all evidence of what he did and all that happened is gone. He is rescued by a hermit priest, and he has to confesses his crime. He feels this need to confess his crime. He does so. He is forgiven, but he is given a penance, and that penance is that he must travel throughout his own country, and when he sees a person who needs his story, and he'll know, he has to tell this. He has to sort of reconfess, retell his story, and that's what he's done to this wedding guest. And he ends it, you know, his tale to the wedding guest, he ends with this sort of a moral. The poem does get a little didactic, that essentially says, he prayeth best who loveth best all creatures great and small, for the same God who made thee, he made and loveth all. This is the kind of wrapping up of the mariner's tale. And he's telling the wedding guest that there is an element of rancor, there's an element of hatred, there's an element of contempt for other beings in you. And that thing, if it is brought to its fullness, is going to result in, you know, the separation of you from everyone else and probably the death of many people. And then he leaves the wedding guest. And one of the interesting things about the poem, and we'll maybe talk about this as we get further into the podcast, is that the wedding guest, he's heard this story. It seems to have lodged deep in his heart. He seems to recognize himself in the mariner's actions and plight. And then he turns away from the wedding door. So he does not go back into the wedding. And that, I argue in the article, and we'll perhaps talk at length, is because he recognizes that he's not yet ready for the sort of depth of both human and divine communion that a wedding in our poetic as well as in our religious tradition that signifies. Maybe that was longer than necessary, but that's the arc of the poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Well, every week I keep checking, and still I am going to ask many of you, because I know there are thousands out there who listen to this podcast, would you please just take a moment and rate and review us, specifically on Apple Podcasts? Because I think I told you that the majority of people, I think 60% of people who worldwide who listen to podcasts, listen on Spotify or Apple. And so if you could just give us a rating or review, that would be really helpful to us, just because the way the world works online is the algorithms need to see that people are interested in your content in order to push it out to other people. And they do that. One of the prime ways they do that is through ratings and reviews. So if you could just give a sentence or two, I mean, why do you keep downloading these episodes? Just one or two sentences would be great. If you are a newer listener, welcome. There is so much back content that you can discover. We have just covered all kinds of different topics, and we cover Christian apologetics and theology, cultural apologetics, and today, of course, literary apologetics. There's a lot that we can learn from literature that points us to the gospel and to Jesus Christ, and helps us to think about different things and the ways that we can use those different topics to have people who are not Christians consider the claims of Christianity. So we hope that you will be thinking through just the ways that you can practically use this podcast. Now, another thing is, I know some of you are very busy and it's hard for you to read our articles because they're not just the typical short, you know, 300 or 400 or 500 word article on the internet. These are in-depth articles of thousands of words. And so please subscribe to our newest podcast that debuted a year ago called Christian Research Journal Reads. How we're picking those podcasts is really based on what's most popular. In other words, people are hitting that article on our website a lot, so we'd like to offer an audio version. We have thousands of articles on our website, so if you aren't already subscribed to that podcast, which is more than 50 episodes right now, please do so, Christian Research Journal Reads, and you can download it wherever you subscribe to your favorite podcasts. And of course, we are always grateful for your support. And if you can give us a tip, since we've gotten rid of paid subscriptions, we'd be so grateful. We still have a budget that we use to remunerate our writers and to produce this podcast, which is completely free, and our Christian Research Journal Reads podcast. Simply go to equip.org, click journal, click Postmodern Realities, and any of the landing pages will give you a link where you can give us a tip. Well, thank you for listening. And now back to my conversation with Dr. Stephen Mitchell about the poetry of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. You kind of started telling us that it begins with a wedding. And so I want to ask you, why do you think, you know, he's going and he's making penance by telling the story, but why do you think there is the reason that in this particular telling, it is to someone who is a wedding guest?
It's a good question. So I think that the reason is because the wedding represents sort of the heart of, you know, the bedrock, if you would, a marriage of human communities. It is where a sort of unconditional love is promised from one person to another. And out of that, right, out of that love, there's traditionally there's a fecundity, right, as new life is welcomed into the world, usually through the union of a man and a woman promising themselves to each other in marriage. And so in many ways, the wedding is a celebration of, in its sort of smallest microcosmic element, it's a celebration of human life, right? And the goodness of human community. Communion is probably a better word here, because community is such a, it's where we throw around too much, but human communion that is both, you know, that's spiritual and emotional and physical in all of its, in all of its dimensions. It is, as any of us that are adults know, it is a relationship that requires deep selflessness if it is, you know, to survive and be something that thrives. And what's more, and I think Coleridge is doing this intentionally as well, the wedding is, of course, an old and reverend image in the Christian tradition of the relationship of God to humanity, especially by way of the relationship of Christ with the church. And the image of a wedding feast is also in this tradition, in our tradition, an image of the final consummation of God's redemption, right? When he, so to speak, marries humankind. It's right in the book of the Revelation called the marriage supper of the Lamb. And then also within that tradition, and I think this matters a lot in the poem, to miss out on the wedding is a profound spiritual alienation, right? It's an idea of missing the kingdom of God, right? To get invited to the wedding and to somehow not be ready for it, not be prepared for it, not be willing to change as you need to in order to attend it. To miss that wedding is to miss what you are made for, right? What you are created for. So by opening this with a wedding and with a wedding guest, I think through that, in part, through that, Coleridge is signaling that this is more than a good fireside tale, right? I'm getting at the fundamental problems of the human condition, the things that fundamentally divide us and the things that fundamentally unite us, and the real like danger to our souls and to our spiritual life that is manifested in any kind of self-centered ethics. So that's how I would answer that question.
So you talk about this bird that comes to them, and that this bird is killed, and it's really central to the poem itself. And it's funny, when you were talking about the doldrums, I think that's the one thing I remember from this poem, was that they end up there. So how does this particular crime of killing the bird not just be kind of an afterthought, and they killed the bird, but really make it something that's central for the reader to consider?
Right. Yeah. So this is that element, like if he had turned around and shot one or more of the men on the deck there with him, or one of the more of the crew members, that would feel more obviously wicked, right? And we would immediately see the problem with that. But I think Coleridge recognizes that, and he wants to press the point here that refusing to love, and by love that means to acknowledge the essential rightness of the being of another creature, refusing that to any part of the creation has implications that are, in the end, quite horrific. They, you know, this albatross, yeah, it's a bird, right? I mean, I don't think Coleridge was a vegetarian. I don't think the implication here is you shouldn't hunt. I don't think it's any of that. It's that there's this bird. It's this living creature. They welcome it. I think it's really important, as if it had been a Christian soul. It wasn't. They knew it wasn't. But they bring it into their communion, right? They welcome it as a lovely and wonderful being. They celebrate its life. They share their food, that which sustains them. They offer it. In other words, they are hospitable. And Coleridge is intentional about pointing this out. They're hospitable to this creature. They're saying, you belong in this world, right? Until the mariners' own fear takes over, that they are on a ship, right, with limited resources, and this bird is cutting into those, right? Now, he's hardly eating a lot, but he is eating some of their, you know, the limited resources that they have. And that's the point that Coleridge is trying to make here, that this is, and what's problematic here is this is an overt and intentional sort of premeditated act of inhospitality, a statement that I have decided that a being such as yourself has no more place in the created order because I fear what your having a place in the created order will do to my place in the creation. And so Coleridge is trying to suggest, and I do think for Coleridge there probably is a kind of, he probably wouldn't use this term in his time, but we would say today there is a kind of concern with environmental ethics here, with the rise of the Industrial Revolution that certainly spurred much of Romanticism. I think he is asking about our willingness to recognize that other things than humans have a legitimate claim on living, on being alive, right? On having a part, if you will, in the gift of being. And he feared, I think, with some prescience, with some real insight, that when once we start to behave toward non-human creatures as if the only thing, as if they have no legitimate place in existence, in being, in the world, if I find them at all sort of competing with what I want, I think he believed very strongly that that would also eventually work back upon human beings. And which is why at the end, I think he says to the wedding guest, right, he prayeth best who loveth best all creatures, great and small, for the same God who made thee, he made and loveth all. What Coleridge is concerned with here in that, I think, is that it is this attempt to find some other basis than divine love, first of all, as the ground of being, and second of all, any other basis than love as the fundamental foundation of our ethics. I recognize that ethical decisions get very, very complicated and complex, but if anything other than that is the foundation, then we are going to eventually end by destroying pretty much every living thing around us. We're gonna end up hating the world that is given to us. And so that is why how I think it is saved from a sort of what might be a look like a surface triviality. He killed a bird. How can that deserve all that he suffered? Well, the problem is that all that he suffered is, for Coleridge, the sort of poetic working out of the ethical roots of his decision making. Right, I will eliminate everything which I perceive as a threat. And so two things. I will eliminate everything that I perceive as a threat because I think the world is essentially an ominous place of limited resources and I'm on my own. There is no divine goodness upon which I can rely. I am on my own. We are on our own, however you want to put it. And if we're going to have what we need and what we want, we've got to secure it for ourselves against all whose own attempt to make use of the goods of life. Maybe that's better than resources, the goods of life. We have to secure our goods against all who would themselves partake of those same goods of life because those goods are limited.
So in this poem, you've talked about that there's this element of horror to it, and then also just trying to juxtapose that with this idea of hospitality, even the hospitality that they're offering the bird, like you were saying, it doesn't have a soul, yet it's not to be something that's used and discarded. So what is that link in this particular poem between those two things? That seemed very different.
Well, you know, the use of the horror genre, now this is not a genre I know a whole lot about. I don't spend a lot of time with horror genres. But in point of fact, horror genres often turn, I do know enough about them to know this, they often turn on places of hospitality and expectations of hospitality or of safety and security, right? Becoming, in fact, places of dread, right? Of horror, of some sort of murderous danger that was not foreseen. So I guess all I'm saying there is I think that that tension between horror and hospitality is present throughout the many different forms that the horror genre takes. I'm thinking, you know, we did a number of years ago a piece on The Road, which is its own kind of horror work, you know, and you have that image there in that book of finding that basement in a house. It's kind of a larder where one would store food, and what they discover there are actual human beings being stored for food, right? So the image of hospitality is flipped into an image of horror. The point here with the albatross, I'll try to make it more sharply if I can, is it's not whether it's the albatross or not. It's that the mariner has decided that things only deserve to live insofar as he does not feel them to be a threat to his existence. And part of the problem that he runs into here, right, is this, like, the reason he kills the albatross is it's because it's partaking of the food. I mean, they're giving it to him, but it's partaking of the food, and he doesn't want to share what limited resources they have. But getting rid of the albatross doesn't get rid of the fact that these resources still have to be shared, right? In fact, there's 250 other men on the boat. So if the resources of the boat are limited, and they are, right? And this creature is deserving of death, if you will, because he lessens my own portion, is essentially what it is. Well, ultimately, that's true also of the other 250 men on the ship. They also each, in partaking of the limited store of food, lessen his portion. Now, he is not thinking that way. I want to make that clear. But what the poem seems to be wanting to say is that once you start down this road of thinking that things only have a right to the goods of life insofar as their using them doesn't lessen what I may want, then you have turned everyone and everything into a dangerous rival. Instead of seeing them as a fellow being who gets to enjoy the goods of life with you, right? That's what communion is. That's what a feast is. That's what a banquet is. Instead of seeing the world as a place wherein you and I, with all the other creatures, get to share in the goods of life as they are given by God, you see the world as a place of sort of absolute, at an ontological level, scarcity, where you don't, there is no guarantee, right, that there is a providential and good hand guiding all things. And that's really what he's turned his back on. The idea that there is, you know, though the world itself is limited, though the resources or the goods of life available to me at any moment are limited, I mean, there's no getting around that. The source of those goods is himself, right? An infinite, immaterial font of generosity. And in fact, we exist only because of his generosity and hospitality. So to turn against those virtues of generosity and hospitality out of fear that you won't have enough is to turn against the very virtues that ground the world. And so they turn a place of goodness into an experience of horror. A place that ought to be good becomes a place of horror because of the change, or because of the state, if you would, of the mariner's, his soul, because of the way his soul has turned.
In your summary of the poem, you mentioned one of the characters that's on the ship is Death. And then, of course, the other crew dies, and here the mariner is still alive, right? So, you know, why did Coleridge do that? In other words, you know, he's alive and everybody around him dies. Shouldn't that be good? But yet you mentioned to us he has this penance to pay by telling the tale. So, you know, why is that kind of a penance? Why does he face this kind of punishment, even though he's physically alive and all the other crew died?
Right. Well, I think he gets, so as the poem is written, I think the intention is that his penance is the worser penance, right? Yes, he's alive, but these two sort of supernatural beings that accost them, Death and Life and Death, you know, Death gets the 250 living men, and I have some thoughts about why they die. They all put once they're in the doldrums, they all sort of then re-put the blame on him. They hang the albatross around his neck, which is where we get that, you know, this albatross around my neck, where we get that image from. But they curse him, they blame him, they all shift the blame to him, and unjustly, right, try to claim their own innocence. And so maybe that accounts for why they die. But also the idea when they die and their souls leave their bodies, there is, you know, the implication that many of them are going, despite their crime, they're going, you know, to rest in bliss. And so there is a release in that as well. So he is the one left alive. And the way I read the poem, that's because to be alive while surrounded by dead people is what Coleridge is saying is the implication of a soul that turns against hospitality, that turns against that generous willingness to share the goods of life with other beings, be they human beings or be they non-human beings. In a sense, what I would say is that if the way I'm reading the ethical implication of his act is that every other being that partakes of the goods of life is a threat to you, then there is, whether conscious or not, there's an implication that what you want is to be the only living thing, right? You want to be alive so that you have kind of uninterrupted access to whatever goods are available. And so their dying gives him, if you would, a taste of the world that his ethical reasoning implies, one where fellowship is gone, where there is nobody, right, to threaten his access to food and clothing and shelter, whatever is you know, he feels he needs to stay alive. And such creatures as do remain alive, so it talks about slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea, and this is part of the experience of horror, where everything appears to him in this oily, fiery, loathsome, kind of gruesome way that repulses him. Such creatures as remain alive are repulsive. And interestingly enough, there's some lines where he himself becomes repulsive to himself. So that what he experiences is existence without communion, absolute and complete lack of communion, right? It talks about how he looked to heaven and tried to pray, but or ever a prayer did gush, a wicked whisper came and made my heart as dry as dust. So he not only experiences the death of his shipmates, he not only experiences such creatures as remain alive, such animal-like creatures that remain alive, becoming monstrous to his perception and loathsome to him, he becomes loathsome to himself because he has lost sight of the fact that existence is a gift, right? That being is a gift. And so he's not shut out of being physically, but he is, you might say, shut out of it spiritually. I argue in my article that he experienced a kind of excommunication from the divine, from the entire created order, that he is in a kind of hell because he has not received the goods that are available to him as evidence of the goodness of God, and because of the goodness of God, the goodness of all that exists, including himself. And so, by implication, everything, including himself, becomes horrid and loathsome and putrid. It sort of begins to rot, almost, if you would. And he has to endure it. He has to endure a conscious existence wherein he is the only being he has any meaningful connection with. And it's an experience of horror, right? It's an experience of complete alienation and isolation. And so it's life in death, right? I want to remain alive, or I'm going to remain alive while everything around me dies. Or if it doesn't itself die, it takes on, to my perceptions, it takes on an aura that is loathsome. And so no communion is possible, none. And he endures this for 7 days. And then there comes a turn in the poem, but that's probably for another question.
Yes, I was going to just ask you about that. You know, you mentioned in your article that during his journey, there is a subtle grace that has been guiding him. And that grace kind of turns the direction of the poem itself. So talk to us a little bit about this subtle grace that you're saying that is evident in this poem, because you just graphically talked about the horrific element to it.
So, yeah, good. So it's most obvious at the moment of the turn, but I think by implication, it has to have been present all along. He goes on this journey kind of sort of naive about himself. That's, you know, how the journey begins. Unaware of the kind of seed of hatred, the seed of selfishness that's in his heart. But that's a problem, right? To be unaware of the evil that is in us is dangerous. And this journey, it reveals it to him, right? He becomes aware of just how hateful and murderous he can be. And he reaches this point of desperation and horror where he is, by in terms of what he can do for himself, he is utterly lost, right? He's just stuck in this place, but he's also aware of, you know, of his own kind of the bile, the hatred that's in him that is contributing to this situation. He has no power to overcome it in himself, but he's made aware of it. And that awareness, I would say, is the subtle grace, the bringing him to this point where he recognizes the horror, if you would, that is in him. And then the grace becomes overt when this divine excommunication, if you would, is lifted. And it begins by just the imagery in the poem starts to shift from this fiery, almost sort of furnace-like experience of the ocean to this kind of spring and this cooling imagery. Things start to go from looking fiery and blood red to sort of frosty, and from slimy to velvet and glossy, and things start to shift in his perception. And he, as he says himself, I looked upon the water snakes. These were the creatures that earlier were the slimy things that crawled with legs upon the slimy sea. He says, I looked, now I'm going to have to paraphrase it here, but basically he looks upon these creatures and he sees them differently. He says, sure, and I blessed them. Sure, my kind saint took pity on me and I blessed them unaware. There's just this shift in what he sees, right? And he immediately links it to the divine by way of course, by way of the saints, mediated by the saints. That he can see these creatures that were loathsome and slimy and repulsive to him a few moments ago. He can see them as these beautiful kind of, he calls them these beautiful water snakes that coiled and flashed and you know, the light fell off their backs like snow white flakes, like hoary flakes. There is sort of this immediate sort of movement of divine love reaching out to him and love in himself sort of responding, a kind of awakening or a gifting, if you will, to him of a reciprocal love. So it's immediate. The divine reaches back to him by way of the saints, and he is able to respond. So there's not really a time interval here. He responds, and he becomes aware, I guess what I'm saying, of the fact that divine grace has been given back to him by the fact that he is able once again to see the goodness of these other creatures and to celebrate their being, right? Oh, happy living things, he says, no tongue their beauty might declare, right? He's just overwhelmed with their beauty. He's gone from a moment ago finding them just rottingly repulsive to stunningly beautiful. And then he says, that selfsame moment I could pray, which, right, before he tried to pray, right, but he was cut off from the divine, he couldn't do that. That selfsame moment I could pray, and from my neck so free the albatross fell off and sank like lead into the sea. And so he is released. He's released from the curse. And I think this is crucial to what Coleridge is saying. And I'll try to see if I can make it clear here as I tried to in the article. And that is that the fact that his experience is transformed by divine grace is itself the proof that he was wrong from the beginning. And what I mean by that is he is in these doldrums, his entire crew dead, himself, you know, barely alive. He is also, you know, in this kind of this dimension of the world where he is cut off not just from human beings as such, but from, you know, all sense of good whatsoever. He is ontologically, existentially, spiritually isolated. But that's what he thought. That's why he killed the albatross. He thought he was on his own and that it was just up to him to make sure he could stay alive. And what he discovers, like the divine, this is why I say the grace is subtle, they give him the experience of tracing that pretty much to its end. And then the, you know, divine grace reaches back down into his experience and draws him out of it, you know, and says to him, yeah, you're not on your own, right? You're one of the beings that I love. You're one of the creatures that I love. Your experience is not wholly determined by the material goods, right? The material order that you see around you. But your life, the end of your life, the continuation of your life, I wanted to say fate or destiny. Those aren't quite the right words for what I'm getting at here, but they don't wholly depend on you, right? They're not wholly determined by the material order. There is a divine, there is a divine being at work. And then that divine presence continues, right? He is the, it immediately begins to rain, and so his thirst, which has been horrific, right, for days, his thirst is slaked, and he's able to sleep, which he has also not done for a good week, right? He's been forced awake in this situation, not been able to sleep, not been able to drink. And so all of these gifts descend on him at the moment that at the same moment that the divine awakens in him a love that can allow him to see the goodness of the created order, to celebrate it as the beautiful and glorious gift that it is. And then the divine sees him home, if you would. I mean, again, he's working in the Gothic genre, so he can do all of this stuff. You know, angels come down and these angelic spirits come down and they inhabit the bodies of the 250 men for a while, and they sail the ship back to his home. And then, you know, as soon as they get there, they leave the bodies and the ship sinks. And so there's all of this, you know, fortuitous help. But the implication is that divine care is there for you in excess of what you deserve and in excess of what you need. And that is why I say this: there's been a subtle grace all the way through it, and that it is that moment of grace that really yields, if you would, the meaning of the poem, is because had he not experienced that grace, he would have been confirmed in what he thought, right? Which was that I am on my own. And it was that belief that he was on his own that motivated the act of inhospitable killing, right, that got him into the predicament he was in.
So you talk about at the very outset, you know, the poem, he is stopping a wedding guest who probably is annoyed that he's telling him this tale. And a while back you said, well, at the end of this telling, the wedding guest does not go into the wedding celebration, but is going the other way, is leaving. So why would that be? At first, he's anxious to get to the wedding, and then this tale causes him to turn around and not go to the wedding.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I will say, you know, that was the thing when I, you know, years and years ago when I first started reading this poem that I probably mulled the most, because it would seem, right, maybe at first glance, that the sign that this tale had done its work is that he would, you know, go into the wedding a changed man. But I think one thing we have to recognize is that he is quite inhospitable himself toward the mariner when the mariner stops him. He insults him. He says, you know, hold off, unhand me, graybeard loon. He, you know, he's not just annoyed, he's aggressively unkind to this old man who stops him to tell him a story. And I think that Coleridge is trying to show with that this young man himself has that seed of inhospitality, right, in him. Instead of turning the thing itself into occasion of hospitality, right, inviting the man in to the wedding or seeing if he needs food or anything else, he's just, leave me alone. I don't have time for you. There's not space in my life for you and what I have to do. I have things to do and I need to get to it. I think the reason he turns away is because, though, the mariner's story has taken root. And what I mean by that is the mariner has shown him in his own story the horrors that this kind of inhospitable hatred, the thing that it leads to. I think it's not accidental that one of the ship members on the mariner's ship is the mariner's nephew, his brother's son. And the wedding guest identifies himself as next of kin to the bridegroom, which doesn't specify the relationship any more closely than that, but certainly could conceivably be his brother or a close cousin. In other words, the children of that wedding will stand in relation to the wedding guest very much as the mariner's nephew stood to him. And the mariner's actions contributed to, they weren't wholly him, but the mariner's actions contributed to the death of his own nephew. A wedding is a place of communion. A wedding is a place where two people welcome each other with the expectation that they will then welcome more life. It is so fully, if you will, impregnated by hospitality, right? That to be inhospitable is to be at odds with everything that a wedding is actually celebrating. And I think the wedding guest sees in himself that he's not worthy. He's not ready. He's been so deeply undone by what this story has revealed about him. And I would say this, Coleridge, you know, is ethically, I think, spiritually, if we can put it that way, something of a realist. And what I mean by that is that spiritual transformation for most of us does not take place immediately, right? It takes place over a long period of time. Even though the mariner did undergo have this sort of conversion moment, part of his penance for the rest of his life, right, to travel and tell this story, is part of what's transforming him, right, more deeply and more deeply into the hospitable man that he needs to be in order to be in harmony with the divine hospitality that gives him both his being and his redemption. And so the wedding guest turns away. I don't think it's a permanent turning away. Like, I don't read it as he is forever unworthy of the wedding, but I think he has to become worthy in the sense in which, you know, I'm using overt theological language now, but like a kind of sanctification has to take place, right? He is going to require time to have the inhospitable orientation of his soul transformed and reworked so that he is ready at some point in his life to attend a wedding. And I think ultimately the implication so that he is ready in a kind of spiritual sense, right, for the marriage supper of the Lamb, as, you know, as we call it in the Christian tradition, for that time when the soul is united with God, when that wedding, if you would, takes place. But he's not there yet. He recognizes he's wrong, but the arc of transformation, as it is for all of us, that arc is long, and he's got a road to walk before he can, in spirit, I suppose, attend either a human wedding or the divine one.
One of the things about stories, and we've talked about this a lot, especially as we cover, you know, cultural apologetic artifacts from our time, whether it be TV series or films and that kind of thing, is that, you know, it's pointing to a larger story, like you were saying, the true story, the big story of the Bible. And it's easier to maybe grasp some of the truths of Christianity through a story than, say, just reading some kind of philosophical tome. And so as I think about this poem, what are some of the, you know, ethical implications for a poem like this for the Christian that helps us not only think, okay, this is what I believe about Christianity, but also this is what it means to be like Christ. This is what it means to live Christianly.
Sure. Well, I think I would focus in on this virtue, right, which is an essential virtue of the Christian faith, not only of the Christian faith, but of the Christian faith, and that is hospitality. And I think one of the things this poem helps us to recognize is that hospitality is about far more than being willing to have a friend over for dinner, right, or even, you know, some new family visiting your church. Hospitality is fundamentally welcoming the other, welcoming the stranger. And so it means that even in situations where there is a cost, at least overtly, right? A cost. I will have perhaps fewer job opportunities. I will, you know, have to give up some of my money, or I might find myself in a position where there are more people that are going to be competing for a job or a program or a resource that I want to be also a part of, that we don't automatically move to shut them out, right? We don't have to seal ourselves into this stance of us versus them, that we can't do that, right? Because God's hospitable generosity is the only reason there is anything here at all. That's it, right? That's what one of our fundamental affirmations as Christians, it's implied in this idea that we say that God created the world, right? And also that he redeemed it. And so I have to stay open to the stranger, no matter how threatened I may feel. And I want to be careful here. I don't mean by that there's no sort of common sense attending to our security, but we have to remember that we have to stay in this mode of being, of our behavior being motivated by love for that, even that person who seems threatening to us, right? Love your enemies is one of the implications of a pope like this, right? Because if you don't love your enemies, there's a lot of becauses, but one of the implications is if you don't love your enemies, eventually you're also not going to love your brothers. Or eventually what's going to happen is those you now call brothers, you're going to end up perceiving as enemies. I think one interesting implication of this, I remember years ago reading an essay by the theologian Stanley Hauerwas, in which he made an argument against abortion based upon the Christian virtue of hospitality, right? That welcoming children into the world is an act of hospitality that is an answering, right? An answer, a responsive hospitality to the divine hospitality, which, you know, makes life possible at all. So it has implications for that. You know, it has implications for how we treat immigrants, how we treat criminals. And I'm not going to try to lay out absolute policies here, but those who we might be inclined to find threats are the very ones whom we are expected, I'll say that, expected by God to open our hands to open our goods to, and to do everything we can to share that with them, right? In a sort of gathered, grateful celebration of the generosity of God. And so sealing up, getting defensive, locking down what is ours, making sure we're invulnerable to outside threats, these all are, they're ethically dangerous positions for Christians to take, because those positions threaten to turn us against the good beings, human and otherwise, that God himself has made and loves every bit as much as he loves us. That, I think, would be my answer to that question.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, every month we have various and sundry odd celebrations in the United States, and one for the month of February is Take Your Child to the Library Day. Do you have a fun library memory that from your childhood, or maybe taking your kids to the library?
Man, let me think real quick here. A story time, I think, that I took my children to one time got weird because the storyteller got mad at the kids because she didn't think they were listening enough, and she shut down the story time and left. I guess that's not fun, but I thought it was funny at the time. Seemed a little bit ridiculous to me to come in and want to be a storyteller to kids and expect that they're going to sit absolutely silently. But well, that was probably, that's the one that comes to mind. Yeah.
That is a memory. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's the one that sticks out.
Thanks for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Sure.
You've been listening to episode 432 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Stephen Mitchell. He has written an online article in our Literary Apologetics series. His article is called Love Not Rocks All the Way Down, Horror and Hospitality in the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And you can read it for free on our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.